This is Abby, and you are listening to Upzoned. Got my bus pass, been a ride, first class streetcar downtown, where the fine ladies and the peeps are. OG said, don't hurt nobody. Looking this damn clean, got my fit on. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to another episode of Upzoned, a show where we take a big story from the news each week that touches the Strong Towns conversation, and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. I'm Abby Newsham, a planner in Kansas City, a multi-studio. And today I have two guests, very special on the show, Chuck Marone, author and founder of Strong Towns, and Kobe Lefkowitz, who is an urbanist, real estate developer, writer, and consultant based in New York, and also a very good Twitter follow. So if you are currently not following him, I would highly recommend it. Kobe, welcome to Upzoned.
Abby, thank you so much for having me here. As we were saying before we hopped on, I've been a long fan and admirer of the work that you're doing here. So it's really cool to be here with you guys.
Well, we're talking about an article that you wrote today that was shared pretty broadly, and I'm really excited to talk about it. Really well written and a topic that I'm really passionate about. Before we get into it, can you tell us a little bit about your background and experience working in the subject of incremental development?
Yeah, so I started off in planning school. I'm an urban planner by trade, but always knew I wanted to go into development. I started off at the more institutional scale in DC after school, and then you would say maybe more boutique scale after that. And then for the last 3 years, I've been working with a group of partners doing small scale infill. And so I've gotten the opportunity to see the real estate industry broadly and the development industry specifically from the smallest scale to almost the largest scale, which has been really gratifying. And I think given me a different perspective on it, especially coming from a planning background than others might have.
Yeah, I think that you bring a really interesting perspective for that reason, that you can kind of cover lots of different topics within this space. And this article is a really good example of why it's important to have a comprehensive understanding of these issues in order to solve a lot of issues in the urbanism space. So we'll get into the article. This was published in No Opinion, which is a Substack that is a great follow. It's entitled Why Small Developers Are Getting Squeezed Out of the Housing Market. So as you write about, there was a notable cultural shift that has occurred during the pandemic where Americans are increasingly noticing the defects of character and quality of our places. In this space, there's a lot of activists and academics and practitioners that are offering up a number of policy solutions and endless debate that is occurring in this space, from allowing single stair walk-up buildings, which is a really niche but important idea, to concepts around designing safer streets or ending single family zoning, repealing parking minimums, a lot of the things that Strong Towns talks about. There are a lot of silos in this space, and you suggest that there's really no single intervention that could solve all of these complex issues, and that there's a really comprehensive approach that is needed. An incredibly important part of this approach is having a grounded understanding of finance. And this article focuses on how finance shapes our cities, why debt is really used to develop cities in the first place, how lenders deal with risk, and why risk mitigation is critical to understanding why the world looks the way it does. And most notably, you dive into America's housing financial system and why it privileges large-scale institutional development at the expense of more incremental and community-based building. So I think to start out, for listeners who may not really be familiar with how real estate works and what we're talking about when we say small scale and incremental community-based development versus larger scale, I would really like to ask each of you to define what we're talking about when we're making those two distinctions. Kobe, I'll hand that off to you.
I'll take the institutional, and then Chuck, if you want to do small scale incremental, feels like that'd work well. So institutional derives from the sort of investor that funds large-scale projects, institutions, namely. They can be pension funds, university endowments, insurance giants. There can be private foundations, high net worth individuals, so family offices. And these are collectively known as institutions. They are the largest investors in alternative asset classes, certainly real estate here, but you can go down the line, venture capital, private equity. There are a lot who do municipal bonds as well. Because of their scale, they're able to make commensurately large investments. There is sort of this interesting, I'll say myth, but there's this idea that large private equity firms or some hedge funds control housing in America or control certain asset classes. And we've all seen BlackRock or Blackstone or KKR. They merely manage the money on behalf of others. So they're institutional managers on behalf of institutional capital. And so we can dive into what all that means and the differences there. But just at the highest level, institutional development are an institutional capital are just the funds and the activities from pension funds, university endowments, foundations, insurance, et cetera, et cetera.
Love that. Chuck, how would you describe the opposite of that, which is community-based incremental developers?
A lot less zeros. So when you're working with institutions, you're moving monies that has a lot of zeros behind it. A pension fund is not going to invest in the $200,000 duplex conversion across the street. Like, they just can't work at that scale. But who works at that scale is the incremental developer. And so I feel like the biggest difference, or the way I would kind of define it from a financial standpoint, is the bottom-up capital versus top-down capital. I remember hearing John Anderson years ago, the friend of ours who's an incremental developer. He was talking about how you finance projects. And he said, well, you have family, right? you know people, right? And the idea was, like, if you want to get started, you need to go to a family member or a friend who has more money than you and say, hey, would you like to invest $10,000 or $20,000 or $50,000 in my project? For a lot of us, that's a deal killer right there. I mean, I felt when I built my house, my wife and I built our first house, essentially we're incremental developers of our own place. We were the general contractor on the project. And I remember thinking at age 22, like, I'm risking my entire life, my entire future. I'm putting everything on the line. And we're young and we're foolish and we can, you know, work hard and overcome this. But it was crazy. I can't imagine taking my parents' savings, my neighbor's savings, my, you know, my wife's family's savings, and then deploying it in that way as well on this, like, crazy dream that I have. If you want to be an incremental developer, you need to cross that threshold and be willing to put essentially a lot on the line in ways that institutional investors don't do. Institutional investors play with other people's money. Incremental developers play with their own money and the money of, in a sense, their friends and neighbors and loved ones. And that just changes everything about what the dynamics of the transaction are.
So let's talk about how that feeds into the outcome of cities and how they're built. And Chuck, I kind of want to ask you about this because American cities have a ton of parking lots and large swaths of vacant land that really need to be reinvested in order to be financially productive. Why would we not want large-scale institutional developers to come in and deploy massive amounts of capital to get this done and to, you know, expedite the process of reinvesting in urban areas?
I'm glad you asked it like that, because why do we not want them? Like, why are they not, like, the preferred people at the table? And the answer is because while what they do is very large and very transformative, what they do will never, ever, by design, scale to the size of the problem we have. They're incapable of filling a market with enough units to actually make their product unprofitable. They can't work at that scale. They can't work at that level. And so, you know, if you are trying to, boy, the metaphor that came to my mind right now was you're trying to rid yourself of a downed tree. You could take that tree and all you got is a hatchet. You could hatchet on it all day, You could have algae come and just, or fungus come and just like erode that tree. That's what the incremental developers are. They're like a fungus that can spread over everything. And they're not going to be like a chainsaw whacking everything up and doing big moves, but they work like all across the board in like this broad, thick way. It's the only thing that scales to the size of the problem we have is to do many, 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 many small iterations with a lot of people doing them, as opposed to like try to get that one big group to come in and whack away at your problem.
Kobe, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that there's a distinct difference in the outcomes of what incremental developers are able to produce in terms of community, whether that's physical or otherwise?
Yeah, I think Chuck is spot on here. I think the biggest difference is that institutional capital has very high time preference. So they need to turn around their money very quickly. It's someone else's money. And oftentimes it's not, it might be anxiety inducing to have your mother-in-law's savings in your project. But if you really get down to the lowest level, it could be more stressful to have an eighth grade science teacher's money in Walla Walla, Washington, who is, requires that for their retirement. And so in order to get her proceeds, you need to return that capital fast. And there's this high acceleration of and velocity of money versus an infill developer has very low time preference. So Chuck, with your home, whether you live in that for, you're likely not going to live in it for a year if you built it yourself. You're going to spend some time in it. And even if it's an investment opportunity, oftentimes smaller developers are much more grounded in the communities that they're building in than institutions who could be somewhere else. So if you're going to live in a city for 20, 30, 40 years, and you are an infill developer, that is your career. It's sort of your career embodied, and you're going to want to nurture that. And there's a very strong stewardship imperative there, which means that you don't have to turn around the money as fast because you're thinking of growing this capital over many decades as opposed to a couple of years. And oftentimes the return thresholds, which I got into a little bit in the article, it's a very different metric. You might say, hey, so long as I have a couple hundred bucks at the end of the month, I can pay my mortgage, I can pay for any repairs. That's great. Over time, I know this building is going to accumulate in value. It almost doesn't matter to an institution if they have cash flow. They need to revert that asset and sell it for a higher price. And the quicker they can sell it, the higher the internal rate of return, which means the higher share of the net proceeds they'll receive and so on and so forth. So it's all about time preference.
I do feel like as I'm hearing Kobe talk, this is like a deep, deep insight that he has. I want to kind of draw it back to things we've talked about here a lot, which is the measurements of success in the macroeconomy are really about flow and transactions. How do we have enough, a lot of capital flowing through the system? And the measurements of success for you as a family, you as an individual, is not about flow. Okay, great. I can make $1 million next year, but I got $1 million going out the door. I'm not any better off. If I can make $100,000 next year, but I only have $50,000 going out the door, now I'm building wealth. Now I'm actually creating something of value, like this reservoir of prosperity. When we look at cities and we look at city governments, we've been at the local level playing this flow game for 8 decades, really. Like the suburban experiment is all about flow. And we should be playing the wealth building game. And that's a very, very different set of connotations.
Yeah, Chuck, that's exactly what I was just thinking about, that really the primary difference here is time and how long you're willing to hold an asset. And for large institutional development, it is really about being able to build it and sell it and move on and make that money back. Kobe, maybe we can talk a little bit about the concept of what you called the power of leverage. Why is it important to understand finance if we want to understand and influence how our cities are built? Can you talk a little bit about why things can't get built without debt and why debt as an instrument manifests physically in the way our cities are constructed?
Certainly. And then I think this can be scaled up from the incremental level all the way up to municipal finance. The lessons are much the same. So at a incremental or let's say development, real estate costs a lot of money. Construction costs a lot of money. And oftentimes we don't have all of that capital in our bank account on day one. And so we go out and get a loan because that allows us to scale up the scope of our ambitions. If we only have $100,000 in the bank, we might not be able to build that duplex or that quadplex. But if we can borrow $300,000 or $200,000 or whatever the amount is, suddenly that project becomes attainable. And if you're able to add sufficient value where, let's say the total cost of a project are $350,000, but after you finish it, it's worth $500,000. You can put a new loan on that, pay off your construction loan, which is only, let's say it was $250,000. And now you've made $50,000 in net profit. I know that's a lot of money flowing back and forth and a lot of numbers, but it in effect shows that you're able to grow your money at a higher rate than if you hadn't taken on debt. There are different thresholds that you can take on. So if you are risk averse, you might only want to take a little bit, and maybe it's 30% just to top off whatever project you might be doing. But if you want to grow your capital faster and you want to borrow a higher amount, maybe you go up to 70% or 80% or sometimes higher than that. And it just effectively allows you to do more. The example I showed in the piece was that if you have two developers, one who has $1 million in equity, or they both have $1 million in equity, there are a lot of really broad assumptions being made here. We can dive in and poke holes in all of them and say, well, the interest costs will be different and the construction costs will be variable. But if the one developer used $1 million all in equity to build one project and didn't take on any debt, they would have one project at the end of the day, right? If the second developer put $250,000 down and they took $750,000 worth of debt, that's that same $1 million in project costs, but now they still have $750,000 of equity left. So you could do four times the amount of projects with the same amount of money, and ultimately you'll make a higher return at the end of it. So once you internalize that, it becomes very seductive. And we can get into that a little bit more. But
so, it makes me think that for a large institutional developer, if you have an account that has tons and tons of cash in it and you need to invest it, debt is a great instrument for being able to spread that out and make pretty good returns on the cash that you're putting into a variety of different projects. Why don't institutional developers do that for incremental small-scale development projects? Why are they instead building large subdivisions or 5-over-1 apartment complexes and that kind of building?
Well, I think the simple answer is that it's just a headache to do smaller projects for them. If they have $100 million that they need to allocate, then if they put that in one project, they only need to send one person to the site to make sure everything's going well. They only have to make one bet on a city, on a neighborhood, on a market. But if they had built 100 projects, $1 million each, which maybe get you a quadplex in some cities, and others it might be, one apartment unit, and others it might be 20 units. Sorry about that. That's 100 times the risk. So they have different markets they have to underwrite. They have different cities they have to get comfortable with. And it makes things a lot more difficult. And all things considered, if the returns are the same, why would you go through all that extra work if you don't have to?
Yeah. Chuck, this makes me think a lot about the concept of fragility, which we've talked a lot about on this show as it relates to municipal finance, but also real estate development. Do you see kind of this overlap between these things and how this creates a more fragile system that isn't going to be as adaptable?
Absolutely. We've created a system that is incredibly non-responsive to the needs that people have in a community. Kobe's article is brilliant. I feel like this was the best description of why 5-over-1s have proliferated across the country. I have said many times, and I wrote in the book that we've got coming out in April, I wrote, when you see a 5-over-1, you are seeing a financial product. It's not a housing unit primarily. That is a secondary use, but the primary use of it is a financial product. It's a way to get money out into the system through the development process. And so it's not designed to either respond to local needs, respond to local demands, respond to local pricing capacity. It is a financial product that is responding to the needs of banks, pension funds, others to get money into the system in large blocks. I think that from a moral standpoint, if you talk to bankers, they would say, we would love to fund a million, you know, six-figure projects, like small little projects here and there. We'd love to do that. But the transaction cost of doing all those things is just really, really high. How are you going to vet them all? How are you going to investigate them all? How are you going to figure out which one's a good one, which one's a bad one? How are you going to do that? Kobe had this statistic in his article that shocked me. I did not know this. Said in 25% of all multifamily units started in the country. This is in 2022, so go back 2 years. 1/4 of all multifamily units were done by just 25 developers. 25 developers are delivering 1/4 of the units. They're controlling, in a sense, like the bulk of the market. And we saw with the recent trial of the former president, if you saw the one in New York I'm talking about, where he got convicted of like not disclosing everything to a bank and not having to. The thing that I think real estate people look at that and they're like, what? This is kind of crazy. And the reason they say it's kind of crazy is because you're getting transactions happening at that level with many, many, many zeros that are largely based on trust and faith. We've seen you do a 5-1 before. We've got to fund 10 more of these because we got to get the money out the door. We trust you to do it. Here's the money at generous terms. Go do it. But if Kobe walks in the door, even though he's an upstanding citizen who's got a track record and has done these things before, and he only needs a tiny, tiny fraction of that amount of money, how do I vet that? I can't. I'd rather just go with the dude that I know, the place that I know, the place with the you know, the resume and the bank account, and maybe they're traded on the stock exchange, or they certainly have hedge fund backing. Those are all the things that signal to me that that's where I need to put that flood of capital.
So Kobe, in your article, you actually provide some, you know, arguments against your case. In a sense, you obviously dispute it, but I want to throw those questions at you because, you know, some might say, as you write, isn't this just what markets operating efficiently look like? Isn't it better to have a higher proportion of buildings carried out by the most professionalized firms to ensure higher quality homes? And with more standardization of building, shouldn't cost efficiencies be realized? What would you say to that?
Yeah, it's a really difficult tension. And as I was writing my piece, I could hear in my head people saying, oh, well, this is just the market, right? This is optimal. And a lot of small developers are going to make a lot of mistakes. Let's just leave this to the professionals. I think it needs to be measured. The need for housing needs to be measured against community goals. So it can't be so transactional, as Chuck says, where we need 1,000 units, where we're going to allow a large scale builder to build 1,000 or 1,100. Now, whether they will actually do that, because then the market will be saturated and they won't be able to hit the rents they need to, is a different question. And I think we all agree here that it likely won't happen if they had access to all of that information. Austin in the last several months has seen their rents go down 15% year over year because there was a large influx of supply from larger builders, but there was really strong demand tailwinds. And the result of that is that no housing is going to get built in Austin in the next several years. So they're going to go back to an undersupply because housing takes several years to be realized. So there are separate consequences there. But it can't just be about getting heads in beds. You know, it can't just be these are people that we need to put in boxes. There are real qualitative concerns when we allow or we privilege. It's not even allowed. There's almost an implicit selection there because of the way our land use regulations are written. Larger firms to build. You walk around these neighborhoods. I'll use one that I have little trouble denigrating. Well, I shouldn't. Let's say you know, poking some concern with in DC over the last several years. There's been a couple of neighborhoods that have sprouted up that are filled with these institutional boxes. And they're higher density. They've delivered a lot of homes. They're high quality. But something feels off. You know, every ground store retail tenant is a national chain. Every single floor plate is similar. Every building is some derivation of design. I mean, if they're fully built out boxes, you can't really do all that much. And because of, you know, from an urbanism or an urban design perspective, because you have this high flow of money, you're not going to create fine-grained structures. They're going to expand out as much as possible. So you have this horizontal sprawl without much engagement. Some people might really like that, but I think you ask 10 people and maybe 9 out of 10 will say, I'd rather live in DuPont Circle or Shaw or Alexandria or places that feel more at a human scale or more incremental, that I can go to Abby's taco shop as opposed to Chipotle, right? It's a difficult argument to make qualitatively that almost can only be understood after the fact, where people go, oh, well, it would have been nice if we did something different, because you don't have that to compare against. That's the qualitative. And then on the quantitative side of it, and I touch on this a little bit, infill developers will build products that might not make rational sense to a sophisticated investor in New York or Chicago. They might build an oversized one bedroom, or they might build a duplex with a spiral staircase up to some small office that has no purpose other than they thought that would be a nice place that someone could work, right? And so you get these idiosyncrasies in design, but also quantitatively in the sorts of units that are built that simply don't underwrite larger financial models.
Yeah, it's almost like our large financial models are perfectly suited to support big box development, whether that's urban or suburban, and other kind of corporate retail products in addition to, you know, very efficient housing products.
Well, can I really reiterate Kobe's point too? Because I feel like what I heard you say, and say, correct me if I'm wrong, I heard you say that the market is delivering, in a sense, the financial product that is easy to build. It's responding to the finance, but it's not necessarily responding to consumer demand. And I think a lot of time when we think about a market, like this is an efficient market, we think about matching supplier with consumer, right? Like I'm supplying the product, I'm consuming the product. And I think it's important for us to recognize the huge role that finance plays here, because while we think of the people living in the place as the consumer and the building with the chain stores and all this as the product, the reality is that the dominant product in this transaction is the commercial loan that's being written that can then be sold off and bundled on a secondary market. What you're looking at is a 90% a financial product and 10% down, you know, way, way, way downstream of that, this transaction where you and I would live and go to a shop and what have you. And this is a big disconnect, because we build places that are not what the market's asking for. And we do that not because the market's wrong or because we don't have developers who could deliver that product, but we've chosen to finance it in a very centralized, top-down, lots and lots of zeros kind of way.
Well, Chuck, I almost want to say that it's not what the market is asking for. It's almost what the financial products we've created assumes the market is asking for. Because, you know, as Monty Anderson would say, who is an incremental developer in South Dallas, Texas, he creates spaces for what he calls legendary tenants. And there's no financial product that is suited to facilitate the development of a space that is for the best taco maker in town or someone who makes really interesting donuts. Like, there's just not, creative tools are not really well suited for creative uses of spaces and creative business types and very entrepreneurial ventures. That's why, you know, alternative sources of funding are so important. Kobe, can you talk a little bit about what you suggest as alternatives to using typical financial products that can support incremental and small scale development?
Yeah, I just want to add one more thing to what Chuck said.
Absolutely.
And then dive back in, because I think they're closely related. There's a big problem in where a lot of these new developments are delivering, that they tend to only be offering small units, studios, one bedrooms, or very small two bedrooms. And that's not because they don't want to build for families or they don't want people to have more space. But simple economics would say, if I can get $2,000 for a 400 square foot studio, or I can get $3,500 for a 1,000 square foot three bedroom, whatever the numbers are, you can build two or three studios for every two bedroom that you can get, and your rent is going to be $1,500 to $2,000 more. And as a fiduciary for your LP or your limited partner's capital, your institution's capital, you simply can't say no to more studios. And so there's been this growth in single resident households, and we've had to build back to that supply for some time, because for 40 or 50 years, we really only built large single family homes. And then in the last 20 years, we've built a lot more apartment buildings. This curve is kind of inverted. But now we're getting to a saturation point. But it's not what the market is necessarily demanding today. It's what will yield the highest amount for these buildings entirely rationally, not for any bad actors, but the numbers are the numbers, and you can't look at them and make a decision otherwise.
Can I say that in a different, I feel like what you're describing is a market that is dumb and non-responsive. It's like the flood of capital makes us, it's not that they're not responding to a market, but the market becomes in a sense like non-responsive to the actual needs on the ground. And the money, because, let me put it this way, you would get a lot more innovation and a lot more responsiveness if there was less money in the system, because people would have to work harder and think more and figure out the niche. But I can go out and build single family homes all day, and there's enough of a housing shortage where people will fill them. I can build efficiency apartments, and even though that's not where the demand is, people will fill them because there's no other alternative. So I can, in a sense, be really dumb about how I go about things. And the market short supply and the financing and all this will bail me out. So why would I adapt and change?
Well, let's talk about alternatives then. So Kobe, you have a number of suggestions. How is it possible to have a shift where we have essentially recreate a building culture of community-based, local, small-scale developers? Or is that a pipe dream that we shouldn't even be talking about?
It's entirely possible because it's being done every day, but it's a very fragmented and disjointed market. So there may be local lenders, let's say in Kansas City or Minneapolis, who do deals like this all the time with small developers, but they're not exactly advertising their services, and they don't have signs on main roads that like a bank would, or advertisements that say, come in and take our capital. So there are people who are willing to make these bets. You would call that private lending. There are a lot of different types of private lending. One that many might be familiar with is hard money lending, which has a bad reputation because rates are very high, terms can be fairly onerous, but that's a small fragment of the overall private lending market. And so the difficult thing, it's this catch-22 where there are lenders, and if you shake enough trees, I think it's possible to find people who will support whatever your vision is if you give them sufficient returns. And even if you can't, there are nonprofits, as maybe we'll touch on, that are willing to provide loans, but they would have a certain number of qualifiers with those loans. The difficulty is that it takes a lot of work. It's not streamlined in the way that you can go to a bank and get approved in a couple of weeks to go get a loan. Or as Chuck so well says, if you already have a credit facility with Bank of the Ozarks for $300 million, you don't have to worry about going and asking them for every new project you want to do. You just pull on that credit facility. So it's not necessarily scalable in its current form, but it does exist. What gives me hope and optimism is that there are more and more people who, who listen to podcasts like this, who drive around, especially in the post-COVID era, their cities, and they're seeing interesting projects. And you can find owners of any building now by doing a simple Google search, and are proactive in wanting to fund more of this in their communities. There are great Facebook groups, Twitter groups, WhatsApp groups where there are local investors who do this. It is truly a bottom up movement and very grassroots. Some platforms that are trying to help as well, but I think it is going to take time, and we may soon arrive at an inflection point. I don't know that we're there today, where communities say, look, we'll pool our funds together. We'll take 8% a year. And we're getting 8 or 9% in the stock market if we're even invested in the S&P, which only half of the country is. Those are pretty good returns. That's going to beat inflation most year. And I have the added benefit of being able to walk by a project that, every day for the next 30 years, that's a block away from me. That is an intangible benefit beyond the nominal rate of return that you're going to receive. But I think it has to be this virtuous cycle that gets kickstarted in one or two communities, and then it coalesces into something greater. It's happening. How do we provide propellant and broadcast that message, I think, is the next step.
Yeah, absolutely. This is, I think, bottom up in every sense of the word, especially because we're competing with large amounts of capital and institutional financial systems that create very different outcomes. Chuck, do you have thoughts or, suggestions for how we might be able to build differently in cities?
Yeah, I wrote a whole article, I think you remember this, about redlining in Kansas City. And I was trying to answer the question, what would you do to bring these neighborhoods that had been redlined back? What would you do to bring capital in, to make investment, but have it result in not gentrifying them, not kicking people out, but actually building wealth within the community? And what I did is I took the tools that cities use every day to bring in, and I use Kansas City throughout this whole thing, bring in the large developer in the downtown, build this little entertainment district and that big hotel. Cities have no qualms giving away ludicrous amounts of tax subsidy where they lose money, tons of money, doing these like big splashy things. When we look at the big banks, I get why a big bank is not going to pay, you're not going to work with a small developer. The transaction costs are too high. But you're at City Hall. The transaction costs, you got people all over the place who can do these things. I'm not saying that they have nothing going on, but if anybody has the incentive to do 10 small projects instead of one big project, it's people sitting at City Hall. Like, that's the kind of things we're asking them to do. Cities have amazing access to capital that regular people don't do, all the way from like co-signing on a loan. I mean, as crazy as that sounds, the idea that the city could go in and say, yeah, we'll co-sign on that loan. When you talk about those loan to value ratios and all the things in Kobe's article, all of a sudden, if the city is your backstop, like I can make that loan. Like, I'm not worried about it. Cities have the ability to make improvements on property or to actually make investments and assess them out. So the cities can actually jump the line in front of everybody else and have, in a sense, guaranteed returns on their project because they can tie it to the property. Cities have amazing financial tools to work with that, if they wanted to, could really jumpstart and supercharge incremental development. At the same time, cities can, and I know that this will tick some people off, and I know this can be controversial, but cities can protect their neighborhoods from this flood of capital. I think that it is grotesque when you have a neighborhood of single family homes and duplexes that needs some incremental developer love to come in and thicken it up and mature it, where you create the incentive to come in and tear down four homes and build a 5-over-1. What you have done is you've distorted the underlying market to where no incremental developer can work in that neighborhood. And the housing advocates will say, well, yeah, but we're getting more housing units. You're getting more housing units today, but you are not getting the kind of at-scale solution to your problem that you should be getting. The nuanced bottom-up, we're going to build 3 units here and 2 units here and a 4-bedroom over here and really respond to the market. So I think cities have the capacity to protect their markets from the rush of capital while they can deploy their own mechanisms to really supercharge incremental development. And by the way, at like very low risk, hardly spending any public money for almost nothing, for really just like reorienting your existing staff in a different way. Cities spend dumb money trying to build affordable housing, I mean, you watch them all the time spending ridiculous money on units where like it's $1 million a unit, but now it's affordable because the city took the loss. Cities can do this at scale, partnering with small developers without losing a dime.
Kobe, I see you nodding. You're the developer on this interview. Is this something that you would use if a city had a program like that?
1,000%. And Chuck's totally right here. You see affordable housing units in California and certainly New York that are going for $1 million a door. And in market rate units, you could build for $300 or $350. And it's not just the initial capital loss. Those units take three times as long as a market rate unit. And this isn't like a reflexive ideological opposition to affordable. I think if we could build affordable, actually affordably, and we could do it quickly, I'm all for it. I'll build public housing, anything that I can build quickly of great quality that, you know, that benefits a community. But the simple fact is that it costs three times as much, takes three times as long. And then you have perpetual losses because those units need to be subsidized because the market rate can pay for, a lot of people don't believe this, but most new buildings don't generate much cash flow. It's all a depreciation play. So if you're only making 2 or 3% net cash on cash on a market rate building, an affordable building is probably losing 6 or 7% net cash every year. So from that perspective, certainly, and there's a raft of other consequences that you probably don't have the scope or time in this talk for, but they're certainly there. But yeah, if a city said, we are going to unlock our purse strings, or we're going to give tax stabilizations, we're going to, you want to be careful not to be too prescriptive and say that we're going to inhibit lots that are more than 50 feet wide or whatever the case may be in order to, but I think you could add extra carrots and incentives to small scale investors. One example, this is at a federal level or maybe the provincial level in Canada that I've been talking about recently, because I have some friends who are building across Canada, and there's a program where they can get up to 90% loan to cost on a project. Maybe it's 85, but it's very, very high. So you don't have to put almost any equity down. And the interest rates are deeply subsidized. But that's a supply side subsidy, as opposed to a demand side subsidy, which is affordable housing, which doesn't help the housing shortage at all. It actually accelerates it because you're not providing any more homes, you know, and it's a very simple supply demand problem. So if cities had funds where they could say, we're going to act as a local lender and we're going to give 80, 85% loan to construction cost, and we're going to give you interest rates. Let's say you could get 7% at a traditional bank. We're going to give it to you for 5 or 4 or whatever the number might be. That is, would be great for a developer, and it would be even better for a community because they could attach contingencies that say, we don't need this to be capital A affordable, but you know, 100% AMI, 90% AMI, see what works and work closely with developers and see that, you know, I'll only speak for myself, but you guys know several developers who are like this as well. I'm an urban planner. I want to create great communities. I'm not here to make as much money as possible. If I wanted to, I would have gone to work for a large private equity firm out of college. I never did. And so it's about cultivating the people who want to improve your community and not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Yeah, there are bad developers out there. There are people who give us a bad name. There's no doubt. I'm not here to cover for anyone who doesn't deserve it. But I think it's important to view that the developers in your community are the same way that, you know, there might be in a farming community. They're providing an existential resource, and we should view them as partners and allies as opposed to adversaries.
Yeah, I think that is incredibly well said, and we are running out of time. So I think that we just leave it there, unless Chuck, you have something that you want to add to that.
No, that's really good. I think just reiterate, this is a fantastic article. If you're interested in incremental development and understanding why, despite everyone's best intentions, it is not happening in the way we want, go read the financial stuff. And if you find yourself like getting hung up with the numbers, just read it slower, because it was really important to grasp this stuff, because we've created a marketplace where we've chosen a certain style of development that we are going to give huge incentives to and preferable market treatment to. And we really need to understand that.
Yeah, Kobe, thank you so much for joining today. Big fan of your work, and you know, don't be a stranger. You're always, even if it's an article that you didn't write that you just feel like you have to talk about, you are always welcome on UpZoned. So
I really appreciate that, guys. Thank you so much for the kind words. It means a lot. And it's been such a pleasure to talk.
Yeah, this is a great conversation.
I want to see if Kobe has a down zone.
Yeah, we do. So before we finish today, it is time for the down zone, which is the part of the show where we share anything that's been going on in our worlds. Kobe, I'm going to put you on the spot, if that's okay. And you've listened to UpZone, so you know about it. What have you been up to these days?
So I have two. One that we talked about before the call. I'm a big basketball fan. Unfortunately, today, Knicks fan. You know, we've had a lot of injuries, but the Timberwolves have been amazing to watch this season. And so I'm generally, you know, an NBA fan. So been watching a lot of that. And then my nerdier, what I've been up to, there's this excellent book that was written, I think, in the 70s called Bricks and Brownstone by Charles Lockwood, I believe. And he charts the course of the townhouse in New York City over the course of 150, 200 years. And I've always been so fascinated by people who are able to walk around and say, oh, that's a federal style, and that's Neo-Grec, and that's Art Deco. And I'd like one day to be one of those people, even though I'm not today. So this has been, it's been a terrific book.
That's very cool. Chuck, what have you been up to?
Well, I appreciate Kobe's love for the Timberwolves. as a Minnesota sports fan, particularly in basketball, we have had an inept franchise for its entire existence. This franchise started when I was in high school. I am now 50 years old. We have never made an NBA Finals. We've been bad every year. We all of a sudden have what is a very great team, and they are fun to watch. And because of the dynamics of the players, there's a lot of kind of positive energy right now around the team. So it is fun. I'm prepared to have my heart broken at some point, but I said to my cousin last night, I'm grateful for the ride. Like, I'm just, let's enjoy this ride and not be like pre-upset about the fact that we'll eventually lose. I've been looking since we started here. I came back to the studio today, so I'm not at my desk. I can't remember the name of the book. I just started a book this week about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls are utterly fascinating. Imagine that you know, right after the end of World War II, this is what we did. We found these scrolls from like pre-Jesus, like, you know, BC 100, like literally like 2,000-year-old scrolls, and we unrolled them. And it's like an original version of like the book of Isaiah and like all this stuff that, you know, today we read and it's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy, like way, way, way down, translated many ways. Here's like the original thing. And they learn so much about so many things. So I'm reading this book about it. I don't have the name. I'll give the name to Sheena so it goes in the show notes. But it's utterly fascinating. I'm finding it to be really, really wild.
I love that. I don't have any books to share today. I had the opportunity last weekend to go to travel to Mexico to San Miguel de Allende. And I was there for a wedding. And after the wedding, I went on a road trip throughout the region of Guanajuato and basically visited a bunch of little towns and notably visited this mining town that is called Mineral de Pozos. And it's what they called a ghost town and a Pueblo Magico, which is a designation that I think the government has for magic towns. And it was really fascinating. It was basically, it has this history as a mining town during the 16th to 20th centuries. It was settled by the Spaniards during that time. And basically, they were mining for gold in a bunch of outposts between Mexico City and New Mexico. And this is one of those places. And there's a number of, you know, really historically significant destinations all throughout the town and around the town. And I had the opportunity to visit one of the mining sites, which is called Mina de Santa Brigida. And it has all of these different historical limestone, beautiful structures that were built to facilitate the mining process, like ovens. And there's even this really interesting architectural structure that I don't quite understand it. I think it has something to do with like how it deals with wind. Like it's supposed to deal with like toxic fumes, I believe. And it also has some elements of it that was used for like staring at the stars. And there's this really cool like hole that you can look into the sky. Just a fascinating place to visit. I also stopped in some towns that are famous for ceramics and tile. So I have a bunch of great new tile and ceramic pieces that I'm pretty excited about.
Wow. Spaniards mining for gold. What could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong? Yeah, exactly.
That's fascinating. I would love to see it someday. I've never been.
Have to send you pictures.
We've gotten a lot of requests to come speak in Mexico. And I'm like, first of all, I don't know Spanish. I'm an engineer. I went to engineering school to avoid foreign languages, if I'm being completely frank with everybody. But I would love to. It sounds fascinating, Abby.
Well, you can send me if we have a translator.
All right.
My Spanish is horrible, I've learned during this experience. I practice Spanish like every day, but you know, when somebody speaks to you, it's pretty difficult to comprehend new languages. So all right. Well, Kobe, thank you again. This has been a great interview. I hope that you won't be a stranger, and join us and, you know, for an article in the future. And thanks, Chuck, for, as always, for joining in on the conversation.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Abby.
This is terrific. Thank you so much, guys.
Of course. And thanks everyone for listening to another episode of Upzone. Thanks, guys. Let me show you what I'm about to do.